Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, director and writer Mark O'Connor and Aidan Gillen chat about their new gritty Irish thriller, Amongst the Wolves. Chris Wasser reviews the latest superhero movie, Thunderbolts. Thunderbolts asterisk. Yes, we'll get into why the asterisk is there. Plus, all the TV and movies you want to stream or skip for the week ahead. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk, although this Saturday it's coming to you at the later time of 9 p.m. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. If you want to get in touch with me, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. Or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. I do hope you're well and you've had another sunny week. I made a trip to the zoo last weekend with the family. All of us went along, and I want to give a shout out to Brendan, one of the zookeepers there, who got me and the kids behind the scenes to feed the giraffes. What a mighty fine time we had too. The kids were able to feed the giraffe. So my gratitude to Brendan, who you can also see in the season, the new season of The Zoo on RTE, which started last Friday, Fridays at 8:30. God bless public service broadcasting. We don't say that often, but if it wasn't for public service broadcasting, I don't think we would have shows like The Zoo. And The Zoo is just a delight. If you like animals and looking at animals, it really is delightful, and there's great production values on it. So check out The Zoo on the RT player, or indeed on Friday nights on The Box, live terrestrial TV at 8:30. Some people still do that, you know. Nothing wrong with it. Appointment TV. I'll tell you what's not public service broadcasting: Netflix. But that's fine, because they make great TV shows often. And one of them I was watching this week is this.
Because when it comes down to it, you know, we're not scared to do hard things for our spouses.
Are you drunk?
No. I was just telling these guys earlier about how when we were going through a hard time, we took yoga classes together.
I have literally no memory of that.
Yeah, we took several yoga classes together at the Breath Factory.
No, I have never set foot in the Breath Factory.
Yes, you have. Yeah.
The place on Route 80 with the poster of the nude woman in the window.
She's not nude. She's covered in sand. Well, come on. We went like 5 times. We had that teacher who wore a toe ring that upset you.
Are you sure you didn't go with another woman?
Sounds like it was equally meaningful for both of you.
That was a clip from the Four Seasons. You heard Will Forte and Tina Fey there. Will Forte getting the wrong end of the stick about yoga classes. So this is the Four Seasons. We discussed it on Pat Kenny's Box this week. Well, it's my Box. Well, we own Box together, me and Pat Kenny. Let's not get into that. But the Four Seasons was a movie by Alan Alda in 1981. Did quite well, about these different couples who meet a couple of times a year. Tina Fey always loved the movie, and she's written and co-created this. And we have three couples. Steve Carell, who's in terrific form in this, opposite his wife Anne, Kerry Kenny Silver. We have Will Forte and Tina Fey. And then we have the brilliant Coleman Domingo, who's in a gay relationship. He's married, actually, to a very flamboyant Italian, Claude, played by Marco Calveni. And they meet regularly, spring, summer, autumn and fall, the Four Seasons, if you will, from, of course, Vivaldi, as you know. And they are experiencing different shades of their married life. And it's not a spoiler to say it, because it's kind of very early on, but they meet for a regular catch-up in a holiday home, the three supposedly happy couples, and Steve Carell drops a bombshell that he wants to leave his wife, Anne. And what we have then is a study of friendship and marriage over four seasons. This is absolutely delightful. It's funny. It's so sweet. It's very human. It looks lovely. I was saying it's a bit like The White Lotus, only less dark. It's very sad at times, but it's so very sweet and so very funny. And everyone is in impeccable form on it. Tina Fey's great. Will Forte is brilliant in it. Coleman Domingo is just hilarious, sweet. He's having some health issues that he's trying to keep from Claude. It's absolutely delightful. I was saying to Pat that I nearly broke the golden rule of watching TV without your partner. That, as in, I wanted to go ahead. I was so keen to see the next episode. That's how good this is. So I'm really, really... Well, I've seen it all. There's 8 episodes up there. The 4 seasons on Netflix. It's absolutely delightful. Check it out. Warm, sweet, funny, sad. All the stuff you want in a TV show. Utterly bingeable. Something else I really enjoyed was this.
That pressure, it's not something I'd ever seen other men talk about until Fred spoke about it.
It was me against me. Everyone wants more. You're just a commodity.
I won't say embracing them, but look how hard we started. It's almost like a reset. I'm trying to find out what I am now. I've always seemed to be able to flick a switch. I've got to find that switch again.
Now that is a clip of Flintoff, the documentary on Disney Plus, all about Andrew Freddy Flintoff, the famous cheeky chappy cricketer who brought England victory in the Ashes, who also underwent a pretty horrific car accident when he was on Top Gear, and his appearance changed dramatically because of that accident and the surgery that he had. I was really impressed by this. I knew very little about him. I know very little about cricket. I bear it no ill will. I played it once in school. I couldn't help thinking, why are we not just playing rounders? But that's just me. So I wasn't going into this particularly interested, but I found this fascinating for a couple of reasons. This wasn't the usual, you know, prestigious talent, cheeky chappy, has early success, then tragedy, then finds redemption. It's a bit different to that. He was a cheeky chappy, still is. He had great success with the English cricket team. He also maybe drank too much and partied a bit hard. But following his accident, he doesn't have this road to Damascus moment. He's quite lost, even when we see him in the present day, Freddie Flintoff. And he's really struggling with how his life has changed. And it's so well put together. And it does have the normal, this is what happened in the Ashes series, which is all standard but very well told. But it's the scenes where he's discussing and managing his new appearance and what his life is going to look like. It's really poignant. It's only 90 minutes and it rips along. And as I say, it's not your standard beginning, middle and end, because the future is very unwritten for him. And as it ends, he's trying to figure out where his life is going from here. So I really enjoyed this. It is almost ruined, but not entirely, by this really strange, and I can only describe it as an ITV voiceover. This chap who comes in occasionally going, Freddie didn't know what to do next, and kind of really spoils it at times. But that aside, Flintoff on Disney Plus is a really, really good watch and quite poignant at times and entertaining as well. So it is worth your 90 minutes. And then finally, I want to tell you quickly that I had cause this week to rewatch Monty Python and the Holy Grail, because I was talking to Sean Moncrief about it, because the Pythons are re-releasing it on the 4th of May, May the 4th. And I watched the whole thing again. And by God, does it stand up. And I was telling Sean how I remember getting that in the 90s, me and a pal of mine, and we watched it 3 times in one day, because that's what you did when you rented VHS copies. But I rewatched it this week and it's amazing. It's still really funny, eminently quotable. In case you don't know, Monty Python and the Holy Grail was the first movie they made after the success of Monty Python and the Flying Circus. And the 6 of them, Chapman, Gillian, Cleese, Palin, can I name them all? Jones, who's the last one? Eric Idle, there. I knew I could do it. I have no notes in front of me, folks. I hope you're impressed. It's only 6 people. It's not really that impressive. Some of them didn't want to make it. It was funded by Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. And in a way, the making of it was a bit like an album. Graham Chapman, God bless him, was on the verge of sobering up, hadn't quite made it, and was blitzed for a lot of the shooting of it. They had no money, so the famous scenes where they're all going around without horses and there's someone clicking coconuts. That was actually an act, you know, the mother of all invention, because they couldn't afford horses. It's filmed in this really stylistic kind of way. And it's, in case you don't know, it's this King Arthur legend and these various knights going around encountering all sorts of strange people. It's absolutely hilarious. And what I found about it was that I don't think I'd seen it since 1993, and it still really stands up. So if you have cause to watch the updated version or the old version of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, it's still very, very funny. I've been talking a lot. If you've been watching any of these things or anything else I haven't mentioned, feel free to email me screentime@newstalk.com. You can also tweet me John_Farley. Now, after the break, I'm going to be talking to the great Aidan Gillen and the equally great Mark O'Connor about their new movie, Amongst the Wolves. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Opening this week in cinemas is Amongst the Wolves. It's set on the streets of Dublin, where Danny, played brilliantly by Luke McQuillan, is a homeless man, and he's trying to maintain contact with his young son, despite opposition from the child's mother, played by Jay Jordan, who has not forgiven Danny for an accident caused by, let's say, his own negligence. Haunted by memories of horrors he witnessed while serving in the army in Afghanistan, Danny struggles to survive alone until he meets Will, played by Daniel Fee, a teenage drug dealer on the run from gang leader, played by Aidan Gillen, and hiding out in a tent by the canal. Danny takes Will under his wing and a strong bond forms, and other stuff happens, as you can imagine from that setup. It's a fantastic watch. It was directed and co-written by Mark O'Connor, one of our best directors, who gave us great films like Between the Canals, King of the Travellers, and the brilliant Cardboard Gangsters. He's with me in studio. I'm also joined by one of our best actors, who's never been on the show before, Aidan Gillen. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
I meant every word I said. So I don't want to do, because we're all from Dublin and, oh, we know the mean streets or whatever. But Mark, it does occur to me that what a lot of people, particularly from Dublin, like about your movies is that I grew up in the 80s in Blanchardstown. So it feels, and I don't mean that I'm right on with all the kids, but for some of us, Dublin on screen, it's paddywhackery. You try really hard to make sure it's a real kind of Dublin as you know it. And I think you've done that in this movie.
Well, thanks. You know, I wasn't kind of looking to just do those types of films, but I suppose, because when I was making short films, I was doing like comedies and horror films and dramas. But then Between the Canals just came out. It was based a lot on my friends and, you know, except for the crime element. And yeah, it just happened then. King of the Travellers, I kind of see that as more of a tragedy, and then Stalker was probably a psychological thriller. But yeah, I've been in this genre like for a while now, so it's probably time to do something else.
Well, let's talk about this genre because it's very important. You co-wrote it with Luke. What did you come together with? Did he say, I have a story about this guy struggling who's on the streets, or how did it come about?
Yeah, so Luke came to me with the genesis of an idea about this character, and I thought, this is interesting. I was working on another project, you know, called We Can. It's a comedy. But, you know, I started as a script editor, and then, you know, I started to work very well with Luke. We had a very similar taste in films and in the story and how we saw the, you know, we were both very interested in the idea of looking into the homeless crisis. Mm. So Luke had his own take on the story, and he came with his own things, and then I came with some of my things that I was interested in. And I got so invested in it then, I came on as a co-writer, and I thought, okay. I got just so passionate about making it then. So yeah, that's kind of how it evolved.
Very good. Aidan, you know, tough gangster, right? But with a smiling way of getting you in. And you've do this very well, this facility to be pleasant to people, but you're secretly possibly going to stab them. Why do you think you have such a facility for that? And you might go, I'm an actor, that's what I do. But we've seen you do this a few times and you're great at it, and you do it in spades in this one. You're a horrible guy, but you're charming.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how that came to be in the first place. I often, when I started out, I was playing a lot of gauche victim type characters. It just kind of flipped at one point in the, it's a long time ago now, but like the mid-90s with a role I had in a film called Mojo. So yeah, look, and hopefully it's just not the same thing every time.
No.
But, you know, if you're playing a an unlikable character or an unsavory character, it's always a challenge and fun to try and make them appealing and to confuse people a little, maybe.
Yeah.
And to try and show how somebody might be able to get away with that, you know, how they might be able to attain that position of power. There's, you know, because there's often a lot of, or an element of charm involved in,
of course,
you know, social climbing or whatever, roguish charm.
Yeah. Does the character of the two guys in this who are on the journey and you being a bad influence on Will, is that interesting to play?
Yeah. I mean, there's also a kind of weird paternalistic thing going on there, which I was tapping into. Now, you know, I suppose we should be clear. It's not, you know, the lead characters in here are Luke's character and Daniel's. I shot my stuff quite fast. It is interesting. I mean, because you're not sure who this guy is. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to have any kids. And you wonder, well, what's the story? He works in a, you know, he's a some kind of boss, but it's not big time. You know, he has a junkyard, and that's not just a front.
Yeah.
It's partially a front, but it's also probably his family business or something he inherited. And, you know, half his income probably does come from that, but he doesn't have any kids and he doesn't, you know, and I wasn't over tapping into that or overlaying it on, but I think it's a way that you would, you know, you would get kids under your influence and get them to do your bidding, to offer them a, and it happens all the time in crime, actually, you know, you're kind of, if you're a lost kid, you know, you can find yourself, given a home or given a father or given a family, it might be the wrong kind.
Yeah.
Terrible influence, but that happens all the time, actually.
Mark, Aidan mentions the lost child there, and in a way, Luke's character, Danny, finds him and gives him some glimmer of hope. Was that a point in the story you thought maybe this is what this story is? It's a guy looking for a, I don't want to Freudian it up, but a missing dad kind of guy. Or maybe that was Danny's part that he wrote. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's definitely an element of the father-son relationship going on there, and the rescue of the loss of innocence and the people that take advantage of this situation. Like myself and Luke obviously did a lot of research into real things that have happened across the country, you know, acts of violence or, you know, where teenagers have been involved. And but we didn't want to base it on any particular thing. It was more around about, but there was also mental health, you know, issues going on there. And so it was a kind of a molding of a lot of ideas that came together and to create a kind of a layered narrative, which all worked in one way. You know, and we were trying to make this for an international audience.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a, we weren't trying to make a social commentary film, like say a Rosie, which is a great film.
Yeah.
But it's not that type of film.
No.
It's for an audience. But it's got underlying messages within there, you know, without trying to preach.
And the funny thing is, I just want to be clear, like we're talking about heavy stuff about missing fathers and stuff, but this is a great crime thriller as well. And I actually thought at times, I wonder in your thinking anywhere, and bear with me for a second, but Taxi Driver.
Yeah, like Taxi Driver is like the ultimate classic, you know, rescue narrative, you know, where you've got the antagonist.
And was that in your mind at all? I'm not saying you ripped it off or anything.
It was definitely, it's always been in my mind, you know, watched it as a kid, like, and a lot of those rescue plots, because you have, usually you've got three characters. You've got the bad guy, the good, the rescuer.
Yeah.
And you've got the victim, and it's the play, the interplay between those three characters, and how that evolves over the story. But then bringing Aidan on board brought everything to another level, because you know everyone ups their game when there's such a talented actor in there. And you know, bringing in like Luke is great, I think, in the lead. Like
absolutely,
it's great
brilliant.
To bring a new generation of actors through. I think on this with Daniel Fee and Luke and. The women in the film are amazing, I think, you know, like Louise Burke and Jade. I wanted to give them a mention as well.
Absolutely. And sorry, I did mention Jade in the intro as well. And sorry, the lady who plays, I suppose, the care worker in the hostel, her name is?
Oh, that's Louise Burke.
Kate.
Brilliant up-and-coming talent.
Fantastic as well. Absolutely. Tell me this, did it I was saying to Aidan before we came on air, this might have been, I keep meeting people who say, oh, I did that 3 years ago because COVID happened. Or a guy last week released a documentary and it was 5 years ago. You actually filmed this more recently than that, did you?
Yeah, we just, like, we kind of wrote it in about 6 months and then shot it in 15 days with 3 days of reshoots.
15 days.
Yeah, and then we posted, edited in kind of 3 months. It was a very quick turnaround. And we did it on a low budget, you know.
Okay.
It was out, kind of outside as an independent film. But it was great because that gives you a lot of freedom then to go all out and, you know, you don't need to be told you can't do this and you can't do that.
Yes.
You know, but then sometimes you have to be careful. You have to rein yourself in and not make it too crazy or exploitation, you know.
Yeah.
I think my previous film, Stalker, was a bit too out there. You know,
because
when you don't have people telling you, you can't do it, you know, sometimes you just go crazy. But no, our producer, Jeff, was great as well with holding the whole ship together. And Paul Ritchie, you know, who's in the film, getting us all the locations and the music. And the cast and crew were on this were just so incredible, you know, because we were trying to put something together for a low budget, but make it something that looked like it was made for millions.
Yeah.
And make it, you know, yeah.
I think you've succeeded.
I don't think Stalker was too crazy. It's funny because you had said there about Mark's films being rooted in a kind of a realistic thing. I mean, the first one that I saw as, you know, most people would have been Between the Canals, which I went to after hearing it being denounced on RTE radio.
Not here, but anyway.
By somebody on an arts panel who said that these characters should not be represented on screen. So I immediately thought, let's go and have a look. But I found it that it had, you know, it was sort of straight up, you've got this great Damien Dempsey song, it's Factories, Trains and Houses, and images of, you know, old images over the years of rundown areas of Dublin or whatever. But it wasn't just gritty, you know, realistic Dublin. It had this magical element to it, as did Stalker. I mean, if I hadn't have seen, you know, both of those, particularly Stalker, actually, I would have been a little less inclined maybe to pursue our... We've been talking about doing something for a while.
Okay.
But, you know, I found what was going on in Stalker really interesting because it was rooted in a realistic, you know, had a very realistic base, but it got into just quite high, heady territory. And
wow, thank you.
I found that very appealing.
I didn't know you'd seen it. I didn't know you'd seen it.
Like group therapy.
When you were there, I was at the Galway Film Fly.
At the right. Yeah.
Anyway, that's another story.
Well, yeah, Shin Scale. But so, and I didn't want to get into this, but so were you disappointed by the reception Stalker got?
Oh no! Like no. I was delighted. Yeah, like we self-distributed because we made Stalker on it. It was the first crowd-funded film in Ireland. We made that.
Was it the first one ever?
Yeah, it was 15 grand. So that was great. It came second runner-up in the Galway Fla, but we'd never released it. And it was Barry Keoghan's first debut in a feature film. I've just been, like, it's been coming out now, little clips on TikTok, so it's kind of getting a revival.
It's big if it's on TikTok. Tell me this, Aidan. Is it important for you that you continue to do projects like this that are grounded or otherwise in a place that you know well, like a smallish Irish movie with big ambitions? Is that an important part of what you do?
Yeah, it is. It's something I've always done. And I've, since I suppose the beginning or since I've started being able to work internationally and I suppose being able to make a living, it's been important to me to kind of keep in with the smaller project. Because, you know, in a way, if you've got any kind of reputation or profile, it can help to get other people involved. It can help to get things going. I think it's kind of your duty in a way to support the local industry. And I don't just do it here. It's also in Britain or in America. You know, I've been involved in quite a lot of projects which would be this end of the scale. They're not high budget, but high ambition.
I know, and people think of, you know, Game of Thrones and all that, but you've done lots of smaller things in other countries as well. And, you know, I was talking to, it's funny you say since you became an actor, a little name drop, but I was talking to Jesse Eisenberg earlier in the year about A Real Pain, great movie, by the way. And he was just saying, you know, I was asking about The Social Network and he said, you know, people think that's my big success. That's when it all happened. But for me, my success was the day I realized I could make a living as an actor. And I think you might have said something similar before. The day that, because you talked to me once about, in a different life, about, you know, looking for change down the back of a sofa to get kids' lunches and stuff when you were struggling. But it seems to me when you realised you could make a living at this, that was probably the day you felt you succeeded, as opposed to The Wire or any of that stuff. But you tell me, it's your life.
Yeah, I can't remember what I said then, but yeah, I never was hugely ambitious. I mean, I had an idea that I'd love to be an actor, a screen actor, a theater actor when I was, you know, 14 or 15, and managed to kind of get that going when I was about 18. By the time I was 30, you know, I had my first kid. So you're looking at the future of getting your kids through school.
Absolutely.
And your two kids through school, whatever, which is, you know, that's long, long past at this stage. So I've had beyond, you know, whatever career I've had or whatever success I've had at it, it's kind of gone, it's already beyond whatever I would have been happy with.
Yeah.
So that's all good.
Mark, you know, we keep reading about it's a golden time for Irish movies, you know, the success at the Oscars and all sorts of things, and even our TV production. Do you have a sense that this is a great time to be working in the industry? Or sometimes I think that's something that maybe people like me say, because we look at Oscar success and stuff like that. But that, you know, you've been doing this a while now, 12, 14 years. Do you have a sense that it's a different time than when you started?
I think it's a different time. It kind of depends on how you're positioned in the industry. You know, if you've got a name and you've kind of been recognized, it's probably easier to get roles or to get jobs.
Mm.
If you're starting out making your first feature, it's difficult. You know, I think it's harder to maybe access finance, although Screen Ireland are great and they have a good budget now. But internationally, you know, it's harder to get Netflix, these, you know, streamers on board to make a movie, especially because they just want to go with the, you know, the old timers or people that are, you know, on a big level. So I think it's difficult in that way. I think AI filmmaking is coming up, you know.
Okay. Are you worried about that?
No, like it's inevitable, and I think it's a positive thing in many ways. I think it does affect a lot of the post-production, kind of the big movies, the green screen stuff, you know, that's all going to be affected. Mm-hmm. And ads, commercials, I think, you know, are definitely affected. But I think when you're talking about drama, like it's very hard for AI to write an actual screenplay.
Absolutely.
And develop it properly, you know. It can write treatments and log lines, you know, fine, but it's different when you develop something. It's a different thing, I think.
Finally, Aidan, I'm not going to ask you about Game of Thrones, right? Because it's long since passed. But I do want to briefly, because one of my favourite things ever, any cultural act of fact, is The Wire, right? And I'm just wondering, did you have any sense when you first got the script, God, this isn't like TV as we understand it? Or even, I imagine, when you got the script for that, it was kind of confusing, because it was even confusing for a viewer. And it was this multi-faceted tale about a city in America that was like, people compared it to Dostoevsky and all that kind of stuff. But I wonder, did you just get the pages and go, this is a job I'll do? Or what was your sense when you first got it?
Well, first of all, it wasn't pages that I saw. It was a VHS cassette.
Oh, okay.
And also I was joining something that was already underway.
Yeah.
They had just finished shooting season two, which hadn't aired yet. Season one had aired. It hadn't been seen, you know, as widely as it was in subsequent years, because it really didn't take off. You know, it took off, but like after the fourth season was when its viewership just really kind of shot up. And then in the subsequent years, it's attained a really quite iconic status.
Yeah.
But I was doing a theater show in New York. Producer Bob Colesbury came, called us for a meeting, talked about this character, handed me a VHS of something that they just edited that hadn't come out yet.
Okay.
So I was watching, I saw an episode of something that I wasn't familiar with.
Okay.
It was actually a great episode. It was the penultimate episode of this second season. And I was like hugely impressed by it, just as a one-off, even though I didn't quite sure who everybody was. But I was able to chat with Bob Colesbury about it. Another film that he'd produced, which I was familiar with, which was called City of Hope, a John Sayles film.
Oh, yes.
Which was kind of similar in a way to what The Wire did, you know, that kind of multi-strata storytelling of that kind of Rust Belt American city, yeah. which was like Jersey City in yeah. that case. So I kind of knew where it was coming from. As far as it becoming, what it was kind of apparent by the time I was there working on it, but I hadn't actually read anything or seen anything when I came on board. And it was really after season four, this season with the high school kids,
yeah.
that just because those kids were so vulnerable and people, anyone who knew anything about America and about what those cities are like knew that the odds were stacked against these kids yeah. and just really wanted to see who was going to make it out, if yeah. any, you know? And I think that's something that really got noticed. Mm-hmm. And of course, then with just the change in the way people watch things and the availability yeah. of things and streaming and yeah. et cetera, it was just more widely available. And people over the years writing about it, you know, there was a curiosity.
Yeah. That remains to this day.
Yeah.
Finally, back to Amongst the Wolves, which we're all here to talk about. I presume it's your hope that this travels far and wide. You mentioned an international, you know, that this is a story that could be any modern city about a boy and someone who comes into his life. Has there been an international reaction to it so far of anyone you've shown it to?
Yeah, like we've played in Newport Beach in LA, great reactions, and we played Manchester.
Okay,
we played Spain, so it's had a good run in festivals internationally. The feedback has been cool, like to hear it from people. Yeah, in terms of like the release outside of Ireland, I don't know the full details, but I think it's actually getting a cinema release in America is unusual because I think they're. The UK, they're going to go straight to streaming, but so it's going to do Ireland cinema, then UK streaming, and then and then American cinema. I don't know why. Maybe because Aidan is such, you know, respected over there. It'd be interesting to see.
Yeah. What happens, yeah, and I presume, you know, there's something great about it going into the cinema where people can stand up and pause it. I presume as a filmmaker, if I go to see this, unless I choose to leave, I have to stay with it for the 2 hours it's on, right? Like I get the sense from filmmakers that I talk to now that TV's great and all, like The Wire and everything, but you can't, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you can't beat that experience of an audience has to commit to this film if they go and see it in a dark room with everyone else. I am putting words in your mouth.
Well, like, yeah, if they buy a ticket and they're in there for a couple of minutes, I don't think they'll be leaving.
Absolutely. Aidan, I have to ask, can you tell us what's next?
I've been pretty busy actually last year. Just finished wrapped on a film called Panic Carefully with Sam Esmail, director, the guy behind Mr. Robot and Leave the World Behind.
Yeah.
Similar kind of territory, like cyber thriller. Julia Roberts is in it, Eddie Redmayne, Elizabeth Olsen, Ben Chaplin, Brian Tyree Henry, who's a brilliant actor who's really come on the scene in the last couple of years. Did a World War II film in Poland, did a medieval medical drama in Germany and Budapest, did a couple of TV things, did a short film up in Belfast.
Okay.
Film with Lance Daly actually.
Oh, yeah.
So Lance, people will know Black 47
yeah.
and Kisses.
Kisses.
Maybe. Yeah, he's brilliant.
But Lance is a great filmmaker and we shot Trad up in Donegal. I'm pretty excited about that. It's what you would call, I'm not going to call anything actually a small film. They don't, and I don't think about it that way. But
it's a miracle any movie gets made.
Yeah, it's hard to get things made, yeah. but it's like a coming of age story, I guess, set in, you know, in and around the world of kids playing traditional music.
Yeah.
So I'm quite excited about that. And again, a lot of young, new faces, which is always good to see, you know. Like in this film, you've got like, say, Luke McQuillan. I didn't really know Luke, but Luke is this. He's the center, you know, he's co-written it, but it's a great central performance.
Brilliant.
He's really good at keeping it in neutral, which is what, you know, really good screen acting is about. You just remain in neutral gear quite often and listen. And, you know, when you need to rev it up or shunt gear, he can really do it. Again, just watching people do stuff for the first time, first timers, be they like teenage actors or whatever, it's very educational. It's great to watch and you don't really have to do much. Them do it.
Okay. Well, listen, you've been both very generous with your time. I really appreciate it. Most importantly, Amongst the Wolves is in cinemas from the 2nd of May, getting a general release all over Ireland and internationally, it would seem. So go and see it. It's fantastic. I've been joined in studio by one of its stars, Aidan Gillen, and its director and co-writer, Mark O'Connor. Guys, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You're never going to speak to him again. Or what?
I don't like the sound of that. He's not safe.
We need to get out of here.
They'll kill him.
All right, pal.
Where are we going?
I don't know what else he's capable of. Put him down.
I have to tell your daddy that I say hello.
You swear it was a monster or something.
It's time you couldn't run away.
I'll come after you. When I got home, everything felt different. We're gonna fix this. I promise you.
A clip there from Amongst the Wolves. And you heard me talking there to one of our greatest actors, Aidan Gillen, and indeed one of our greatest directors, Mark O'Connor. And Amongst the Wolves is in cinemas now from the 2nd of May. Up next, Chris Wasser gives us the skinny on the new Marvel movie, The Thunderbolts. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now the big release of the week outside of the great Irish movie Amongst the Wolves is Thunderbolts. And there's an asterisk at the end of it. We'll find out more in a moment. It's from Marvel Studios. It's a superhero movie. I was thinking beforehand, we haven't seen a superhero movie in a while, but there was Wolverine and Deadpool not that long ago, which is technically a superhero movie. Let's find out a bit more. Chris Wasser has been to the cinema to see Thunderbolts, which I should say stars Florence Pugh. Chris, a new superhero movie.
John, yes, it's been...
I should have said hello, sorry.
Hello, John. Yes, a new superhero film. I think it's been a while since we've had one of these. I was going to say, because I completely forgot about Captain America Brave New World, as I was watching Thunderbolts asterisk yesterday, I was thinking to myself, has it really been that long? But that will tell you how forgettable Captain America Brave New World is, because I think this is a problematic phase for Marvel Studios at the minute. They are in a spot of bother. And I think the trouble started after Avengers Endgame a few years ago, mm-hmm. where you had this film that brought to an end this 10 or 12 year saga that really did feel as though it was coming to a natural conclusion. You know, all of the actors had reached the end of their contracts. The characters were coming towards the end of this Infinity Saga story. It just felt like, okay, the curtain's coming down on this thing. This is what we're building towards. This is what the audiences have been building towards, and also the studio. Game over. But it wasn't. And everything since then has sort of kind of lacked the discipline and the energy, the enthusiasm, and even just the gloss that those previous Marvel films had. It's also been lacking, A-list superheroes, you know, I'm not talking about the talent, I'm talking about the actual characters.
So and like we've had everything from like the Marvels, the Eternals, and like they've just been forgettable.
They really have. That's the one word that sums up Marvel post-Avengers game, forgettable. I should say Captain America Brave New World, I was not against the idea of Anthony Mackie, who is so charismatic. I mean, you could power in a small country with that man's charisma, John. And I was not against...
Just watch a recent episode of The Studio, if you don't believe Chris, on Apple TV, where he gives a great performance.
He's so good in that. The Ron Howard episode, it is so special. Himself and Harrison Ford in a Captain America film, that should work. I think the problem was with the people behind it. So Thunderbolts, asterisk, feels in a way a little bit like, you know, a course correction where, you know, Marvel is saying, okay, right, we're going to try and take characters that maybe you've only seen Bucky, you know, forget about Bucky for a minute, Sebastian Stan's character, the main players here, you've only maybe seen them once before, so you're not yet sick of them. Let's put them all together and try and convince you that the magic is still in the room.
Yeah. So let's get on to Thunderbolts then. So from what I gather, this is, I don't want to say a gangster movie, but it's caper-esque. I mean, the superhero-ness of it isn't necessarily worn on its sleeve.
No. It's really more of a film. It's not a film about Marvel's actual, you know, A-list heroes. It's more about their squabbling anti-heroes and what happens when they're put in a room with one another and they're supposed to kill one another, but they actually form a new team. So what you have here is the director of Robot and Frank, because Marvel is still doing that thing where they take, you know, beloved directors of these lovely independent comedies and then they get them to manage a big superhero film.
Yeah.
Himself and his team, they're picking up on the pieces of various different Marvel TV shows that have been on Disney Plus over the years. I'm not going to try and explain everything to you. Go and ask the Marvel enthusiast in your life, but I'll give you the basics, which is that Julia Louis-Dreyfus, she is playing a CIA director who has always had ulterior motives. We've seen her popping up once or twice before. She's been trying to build her own little superhero team, and not in, you know, ways that she should be. You know, she's using the super serums that, you know, were tested out in Captain America and the Hulk. She shouldn't be doing that, basically. She's being investigated. She's being impeached. She's in an awful lot of trouble. So she's in a hurry to kind of destroy all evidence of her wrongdoing. And, you know, to tie up any loose ends, including the living loose ends. And that's where Florence Pugh's Yelena Belova comes into it. She is this deadly Russian spy. She was the Black Widow's sister. We know the Black Widow is dead at this point. That's where, you know, Walker, played by Wyatt Russell, who we saw in the Winter Soldier, or Falcon and the Winter Soldier. It's where various different kind of misfits from previous Marvel entries come into it. They're all told to go to this bunker in the middle of nowhere. They're all given their targets. They quickly realize, John, that they're in an incinerator. They're supposed to kill one another. But they also, but what the bad guys don't expect is for them to get along and then to kind of go on this mission to see why were they trying to be killed in the first place.
Okay, so they all come together. So you're talking a bit there about some of the antecedents where we've seen some of these characters before. And like, I've seen most of these movies and I'm confused, right? With all this cross universe, you know, picking up different stories, phase one, phase seven, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But do you need to know any of that stuff to get into this, or can it work on its own terms?
Yeah, a little bit. It doesn't hurt, John. Okay. but for the first hour of this thing, I was quite impressed at how clean and coherent it all was. And despite that, you know, there are times when you kind of half expect Florence Pugh to just, you know, hit the timeout button and break the fourth wall and explain things to us, because it does get a little top heavy at times. But for the most part, I thought it was all right. And I think that's down to, it's interesting, Sebastian Stan, who reprises his role as Bucky here, and is not really that great. There is a sense that maybe he's just grown tired and that he's maybe outgrown the whole superhero business, you know, because he really has gone on to do better things. He's been telling reporters that the filmmakers and the cast, they were influenced by John Hughes' The Breakfast Club. And I remember seeing him give that interview and I thought, what are you talking about? This is a superhero. This is a superhero film.
And could you see that in this?
Yeah. Then I watched it and I thought, okay, it's a bit of a stretch, but there is this nice 40 minutes or so where you've got these superhero misfits, you know, the reserve player, the B players, basically. They're all put into this room. They all have their own idiosyncratic ways. They all have their own kind of, you know, strengths and weaknesses. And they come together when, at a time when they don't expect it. And I thought, okay, there's your Breakfast Club bit. And I quite enjoyed that. I thought there was a chemistry between Walker, or Wyatt Russell, I should say, and Pugh. I thought there was a nice energy in the room. There's some nice comic relief from Lewis Pullman, that's Bill Zionfla, playing this civilian who just, you know, he may have superpowers, but he's not supposed to be part of the mix, but he is. I thought there was just a nice bond there. It's when we leave that room and when it brings in all of the usual Marvel madness, you know, gloopy CG effects and, you know, other just epic threats, basically, that it loses its charm. But for the first hour, I can see what Stan was talking about.
Okay, interesting. So when they go on this mission together, that's when it becomes kind of less successful and more kind of, dare I say it, Marvel schlock.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, there are still some interesting ideas in there. There's some nice ideas with the new villain. It kind of it verges on some horror territory for a minute or two. I won't spoil anything, which I actually would like to see more of that. But yeah, when it starts bringing in more characters, we also have David Harbour in there as the Red Guardian. I mean, no one could ever accuse David Harbour of phoning it in. The energy and and the enthusiasm that he brings to that role, it's something else. But I don't really need to see any more Bucky. I don't really need to see any more threats to New York City in the Marvel films. I mean, it kind of feels as though we've done this. And there's an awful lot of talk about, you know, the previous chapters. So sometimes this film is kind of, it's afraid to stand on its own 2 feet. But I'll tell you, it has two not so secret weapons, and they are Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is just, she knows what she's supposed to be doing here. She's playing this, you know, slippery, oily cartoon villain, and she's great at it. You know, the energy in the room just lifts when she comes on. And then you've got Florence Pugh, who is just, I mean, nobody is too good to play a superhero. I don't buy that at all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there are some fabulous actors that have played superheroes and done them brilliantly, but she's in another league here. I mean, she just elevates the material to the point where you forget that she's doing a terrible cartoon Russian accent. And that's how good the performance is. You know, she just brings this liveliness to it, this professionalism. She's great with the action, the comedy. She kind of mines drama from a screenplay that sometimes forgets to give us any. She's just brilliant. And I think maybe, lifts what could have just been maybe a 2-star mediocre Marvel film into, you know, a 3-star solid piece of blockbuster entertainment, basically.
Okay, so I hadn't got to it, but you're giving it 3 stars.
I think so, you know, and people might hear that and they'll go, well, that's not great, but this is far superior to anything that Marvel has been doing recently. It's far mm-hmm. superior to their other, you know, superhero mashup films like Eternals. It's much better than a film that it will be compared to DC Suicide Squad. Forget it, it's actually way more entertaining. I had a good time with this. The action is neater. The special effects in places are actually quite impressive. There's a story there, at least in the first hour, which I thought, okay, that's reminding me of Marvel at its best. I used to be a huge fan of these things, and this film, for a little while at least, John, reminded me why.
Okay, yeah. And look, I've always made this point that Avengers Endgame, like my kids, it was there. Empire Strikes Back, elegiac the way it ended. I remember, like, it sounds a bit of a stretch, but almost nearly crying during Avengers Endgame when it was all coming to an end. They did it so well. And I completely agree with you that there just hasn't been that fully realized vision for a new chapter. Because in a way, it'd be very hard to repeat that. So anyway, it's interesting to hear that this is as quite good as it is. But I mean, it's certainly not Avengers Endgame, but it's, you know, someone heading out to the cinema for a little escapism, 3 stars this weekend. You're saying by all means, go and see it on the cinema, right?
I think so, yeah. And I'd like to see Florence Pugh actually get her own superhero film as well, where there's, you know, there's not this big crowd around her. Mm. And yeah, and there is like, there are flashes every now and then that of brilliance, that or a sign maybe that Marvel might be able to kind of, if not do what they did before, but they might be able to make some sort of creative comeback. And I'm with you as well, John. I remember that whole saga coming to an end, and we can scoff at it as much as we like, but no studio had ever done anything like what they did in the run to Avengers Endgame. And it was so well managed, so well organized. There was a discipline there, a plan there from day one. There just doesn't seem to be a plan now. And I think that's the real shame.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent. Well, that is... Oh, come here. The Asterix. What's the story? What's that
the
about?
The Asterix. Yeah, we have... We briefly. I think we never really... We're not told why there's an asterisk, but you can make up your own ideas about it. Like the Thunderbolts in the comics are very different to the Thunderbolts portrayed here. They actually involve different characters on the screen. There's this idea that they're not given any official name. There's just this joke that Yelena, that's Florence Pugh's character, she was a part of this useless childhood soccer team, and she tells a story about them, and they say, oh, maybe we could be the Thunderbolts because that was their name. And then there's this maybe joke as well that the Thunderbolts, asterisk, are the people you call when the Avengers aren't around. But there's no clear explanation, but you have the folks at Marvel saying, no, but the title of the film is Thunderbolts asterisk. So there you go. It's such an annoying add-on to the name, but that's the name of the film, Thunderbolts asterisk. No explanation. Okay.
Well, look, I might, just call it Lansdowne Road and leave it at Thunderbolts asterisk if you must. Chris Wasser is giving it a decent 3 stars. So maybe a pleasant way to spend your time if you are into superhero movies, or maybe even if you're not. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
This ends today.
Congressman Barnes, wow. You know, I never really thought you'd have a promising political career, but less than half a term. Yikes.
We're taking you in, Val.
I don't think so. Junior varsity, Captain America.
Walker.
How nice to see you, Ava. Yelena, you look awful. Mm-hmm. You sure you're really ready for that public-facing role you asked me about?
Eat shit, Valentina. Where's Bob?
Look at you. You are all so adorable. Just think, I send you down there to kill each other, and instead, you make nice and you form a team. Who is this old Santa?
I'm Alexei Shostakov. The Red Guardian.
What?
A clip there from the Thunderbolts. Asterix. Whatever the hell that means, go and see it and find out. But Chris, who's pretty even-handed in these things, saying it's pretty decent. So if you're looking for something in the cinema this weekend that's, you know, maybe entertaining escapism, that might just sort you out. But also check out Amongst the Wolves. That's it for this week. Thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. You can, of course, listen back to this show or any of the Screen Times of the last 6 years, which include interviews with everyone from the likes of Julia Roberts to Eddie Murphy to George Clooney and Danny Dyer and pretty much anyone who's made a movie in the last 6 years. You can find, if you go to newstalk.com or wherever you get your podcasts, and listen back to any of the Screen Time episodes of the last few years. Going to leave you with some music from the movies. And I was one of those people at a very dry David Gray gig this week. So I will leave you with his This Year's Love from a movie called This Year's Love, and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.